There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Sneha Anavarapu, the host of this channel, and today I have the absolute pleasure of being in conversation with one of my favorite sociologists, Dr. Gauri Vijayakumar, the author of the brand new book, At Risk, Indian Sexual Politics and the Global AIDS Crisis. At Risk was published by Stanford University Press in July 2021. And Dr. Vijayakumar is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Brandeis University, and this is her first book. Gauri, what a fantastic book. Congratulations. I'm so happy to have the opportunity to talk about this amazing book with you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited for this conversation.
Yeah, so let's start out with you telling us a little bit about yourself, perhaps how you became a sociologist.
Sure. So I think, you know, there's a couple of ways you can answer a question like this, right? So there's the kind of existential, personal way, and then there's the kind of messy, practical way. So I'll start with the existential way, because I think for many of us, that's really where our sociological curiosity originates, right? Yeah. So for me, it was, you know, my diasporic experience. I grew up in a very white suburb of Boston, you know, feeling sort of very alienated in a lot of ways. But I had a very close-knit Indian community. I lived in a joint family and I spent a lot of my summers in India with my grandmother. And I actually, you know, was learning dance. So sometimes I'd spend the whole summer there, going to dance classes, and then I'd be kind of at my grandmother's house, like bored out of my mind during the day while my cousins were at school. And so I think, you know, hanging out and being bored and just sort of observing were some of my first ethnographic experiences, and then sort of seeing, you know, the contrasts and convergences with my life in the U.S. And the sort of, you know, the class and caste privilege we had there, and the kind of racial exclusion we faced here, I think, were really sort of fascinating to me. And then, you know, as I grew older, I think I was really interested in observing, you know, the shifts that took place post-liberalization as Bangalore became this kind of global IT destination, and how that sort of changed the city and changed the way people around me in the U.S. talked about India and talked about Bangalore, you know, so that they're seeing that and seeing the nature of the relationships between these two parts of my life be transformed was really interesting. And, you know, I didn't have the language to understand what those political economic shifts were until I got to college. Right. But I was curious about them, you know, and so so that's kind of, you know, the, I think, more personal answer, and so many of us are driven by those experiences and questions. But yeah, I mean, practically speaking, you know, I had no idea what I wanted to do in college. I was all over the place. And I was lucky enough to go to Brown, where there are no requirements. So I just took all sorts of classes. So I majored in development studies, which, you know, I don't even know if anyone like studies development studies anymore.
I studied development studies.
Okay, so you're another weirdo like me. So yeah, so development studies. I majored in comparative literature. I had a minor in creative writing, and I was pre-med. I thought I was also going to be a doctor. So, you know, I had all these different interests. But I knew I liked to write, you know, and I had this vague sense that I wanted to do something global, and I wanted to do something that had to do with social justice. And so, you know, by some kind of happy accident and luck, I ended up getting to go to South Africa with one of my professors to do some public health research. And my first experience with research was actually this project. And I actually talk about this a little bit in the beginning of the book. So I went to South Africa and worked with these amazing reproductive health researchers. And, you know, my first kind of published academic article was actually, you know, about the effectiveness of the female condom in preventing STI transmission, you know, based on this research. But while I was there, you know, it was the 10-year anniversary of the end of apartheid. And so there were all these conversations happening around me about sort of apartheid and post-apartheid politics. And, you know, it really became clear to me that that was the sort of backdrop to the public health work that I was doing in the sort of AIDS pandemic that was ravaging South Africa at that time. And so when I came back, I wrote my senior thesis on that political context for women's health in South Africa. And so that was my first research project that was really kind of driven by my questions and my curiosity. And that was when I knew that I wanted to be a researcher, was sort of my experience doing that project. I knew I wanted to be a researcher, but I had no idea, you know, what that meant in terms of discipline, what that meant in terms of method or the type of research I wanted to do. So I did a bunch of other things in between. So I actually spent a couple of years working in NGOs. I got a master's, and then, you know, I applied to basically a mix of anthro and sociology programs, and then just decided on a discipline based on where I had gotten in. And honestly, like before grad school, I had only taken one sociology class. It was a great class. It was with Patrick Heller at Brown, this class called Globalization and Social Change. But, you know, other than that, I hadn't had much experience with sociology. So I really learned what sociology was and what American sociology was after getting to Berkeley. But I think that was really, you know, really formative for me too, is that I actually kind of always had this this eclectic approach to sociology and the boundaries of sociology. And, you know, I hope some of that comes through in the kind of the intellectual influences that appear in my book too.
Yeah, no, it certainly does. And, you know, speaking about the book more directly, you say that it's an exploration of how the global AIDS crisis temporarily transformed the terrain on which sex workers, sexual minorities, and transgender people engaged the state, both individually and collectively. And I really like this this rather succinct summary of the book that you lay out early on. So you've just spoken a little bit about this already, but like, what is the story of this book? How did this research project emerge? Was it your dissertation? And, you know, how did it go from being a dissertation to a book?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So yeah, I mean, I think when I started doing research in grad school, I was initially interested in gender and globalization. And I actually, you know, despite the fact that I had kind of studied AIDS in undergrad, when I did my master's project in grad school, I did a qualitative study of young workers at a BPO outside of Bangalore. And it was all about kind of how they relate to the global knowledge economy, their aspirations. And it was, you know, I mean, it was about how these young people were kind of adapting their aspirations to this very constrained environment, right? And, and specifically how, you know, a lot of these young women kind of adapted their aspirations to, you know, the certainty of marriage, right? And so, you know, in a lot of ways, it was kind of, you know, it was a story about neoliberal capitalism winning. And I think I was really craving an opportunity to study, you know, collective assertion, right, and collective challenges to those same forces, right? And, you know, I had also been reading a lot of the literature and transnational feminist theory and later kind of transnational queer studies about global institutions that always win, right? They succeed in co-opting radical politics, they discipline sexuality, they create these kind of aspiring subjects, they suppress social movements, you know, their white savior feminist or homo nationalist projects. And I just kind of wanted something to bring me more kind of hope, I guess, you know, and I wanted to study movements that challenged these kinds of structures. And at that point, you know, and I was sort of transitioning from the master's to my dissertation, I started thinking about my work on AIDS. And, you know, I had sort of followed AIDS politics in India just kind of from a distance. And it occurred to me that this was an example of very marginalized people having this leverage within this kind of moment of crisis in which they were repurposing, you know, international discourses, funding structures, donors, the state, you know, and in a way that, you know, it wasn't that they were kind of individually, creatively subverting them in everyday life, but actually really collectively kind of engaging on this terrain of the global AIDS field, or what some have called the AIDS industry. Right. And so, you know, you had sex workers saying, OK, I'll do this condom distribution. I'll prevent HIV if that's what the funding is coming to do. But, you know, you also need to, you know, invest in sex worker communities and help us build collectives that can stand up against police violence and provide housing and help our children go to school and and challenge kind of violent forms of exclusion from public spaces. And so so I think that was, you know, my what attracted me to this project initially. And I also saw it as a really interesting way to understand the relationships between state global institutions and social movements, and really see all of them as kind of acting together in complex relation to each other. And so that, I think, was what theoretically drew me to this project. And I think it really, you know, it's about a moment of crisis, and in many ways, a very specific moment of crisis. But I do think we need to understand how very marginalized groups engage on the terrains of crisis and what the limits of that are, because we're increasingly living in periods of crisis, right? Whatever kinds of crises they are. And that, you know, has become increasingly clear in the last few years, but, you know, we could say that it's always been true.
No, I mean, thanks. That was so interesting. And even methodologically, the book is such a cool example of the power of ethnography in taking us across so many scales, right? So the book, as you put it, moves from global fields to the state, to organizations, to individuals. And while explicating on this approach, you write that you changed the research design of your project after a brief stint of fieldwork, that it went from being a comparative project to one in which you follow the linkages between the various organizations and actors in the field of HIV prevention. So I have two questions here. One, could you tell us a little bit about how you conceptualize the field in your book? And two, could you tell us a little bit about your ethnographic approach and the methods you ended up using to do your research?
Sure. So for me, I thought of the field, and, you know, there's so much literature in sociology about fields. I was particularly interested in sort of some of the literature on global fields, right? So thinking about the kind of complex of institutions and actors at the global level, including nation states who are working to prevent or manage the AIDS pandemic, right? But, you know, for me, and I think there are some amazing studies that really kind of map out global fields, right? But what I was interested in doing was actually looking at how the state and social movements relate to the global field, right? So how do these engagements in the global field, you know, map on to how social movements engage with the state, right? So, you know, I think my ethnographic method is kind of best suited to that, to really understanding how those global engagements shape these political contestations, articulations at the local, regional, kind of national scales. So yeah, I mean, in terms of the methodological aspect of this, and I think, you know, in a lot of ways when we do, you know, global transnational research, it's kind of, you know, a theoretical as well as methodological question and intervention. So, you know, I started out with a pretty a grounded approach, in the sense I sought out specific organizations where I wanted to spend my time. Mm-hmm. I basically started off by cold emailing people. And then I was really trying to figure out how I could position these different organizations. You know, I got permission to do kind of more long-term research in this set of organizations. And then I also went to a conference that was really helpful to kind of help me. It was the Sex Workers Freedom Festival. So it was a national, actually global conference of sex workers who were kind of connected with sex worker movements around the world. But I think, you know, my methodological shift was starting to see the field as something that you learn about through tracing connections, right? Rather than beginning with a bounded research site. So I had my, you know, sites where I would show up every day and hang out. But I was also doing interviews with people as connections emerged. So, you know, if I was in a drop-in center and someone came from the local state agency that managed relationships to CBOs, then I would go interview that person, right? And then I would, you know, ask people, okay, well, where else should I go visit? Or who else should I talk to? So actually through that, I started to understand the relationships between these different kind of state, non-state actors, you know, some of these global institutions, donors, but through these very kind of specific relationships, right? So it wasn't an abstract sense. I wasn't coming in assuming that a specific institution was going to play an outsized role. And I think this is really important because I think a lot of times when we do kind of research that is at the intersection of scales, we tend to overstate the importance of, say, global institutions on local politics, right? And I kind of tried to treat that as an empirical question, right? So what is the extent to which, you know, AIDS funding actually affected what this sex workers organization did on a day-to-day basis, and how much of what they did on a day-to-day basis had to do with their relationship with a specific local police commissioner or a particular state bureaucrat or a specific feminist group or Dalit group in their area, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, and it sounds messy, right? Right. But I did start to realize as I went through this process that I was able to map the field or kind of understand who the actors were in the field and how they were related to each other as mm-hmm. I proceeded with the interviews and people started recommending me to the same people over and over again. So I started mm-hmm. having a sense that I had, you know, understood how these different institutions and organizations were related to each other.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I also chuckled a lot when I read this part in the book where you write about what it's like to study the post-colonial bureaucracy, you know, like how much of a maze it is. So as someone who has also faced very similar situations of, I don't know, being completely disoriented within the state apparatus, I was curious to know how that was like. How do you negotiate being, you know, from a U.S. university, and how was it placing yourself in these kind of very varied contexts?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because, you know, and I've written about this in an article in World Development about the kind of concept of community and this sort of idea of authenticity, right? So, you know, within HIV prevention programs, I was studying a lot of times when I would talk to people, especially in the bureaucracy, they would say, oh, you know, this isn't the real work. The real community is over there, you know, or you go over there to study the real grassroots work. You'll find it in this place, right? Mm-hmm. And when I read Nayanika Mapu's amazing book, Paper Tiger, she has a really similar kind of description in the beginning about, you know, going to one office and then they say, no, the real work happens in this other place, right? And so, you know, and I found that really kind of resonated with my experience. And then kind of in the process of going from place to place, you know, and it really is kind of physically going from one office to another. You know, a lot of times I was just waiting around. I always had a novel with me. I would just sit there and wait, you know. And, you know, in that process, you sort of start to get a sense of, you know, how are these different institutions related to each other? And also, you know, who, what different roles they're playing and kind of. And what's getting lost in translation along the way.
So now getting to the contents of the book itself, the book starts with an analysis of India's AIDS crises within the global AIDS field. I was very intrigued by the specter of Africa and the African epidemic shaping India's response to the crisis. So could you tell us a little bit about how the imaginations of Africa mattered to determinations of risk and understandings of transmission in India?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, one of the things that, and this is actually something that I kind of added to my book later in the process. And the reason I did this was that I realized, you know, by the time I was doing field work, the idea that the risk groups of note were these three groups: sex workers, what were called men who have sex with men, which is obviously a very broad and problematic category, and IV drug users. You know, these are the risk groups, right? And this was kind of accepted knowledge, and everything else kind of ensued from there. And I realized I needed to actually kind of historicize, you know, how did these become the groups? How did this become the accepted understanding of how the epidemic response in India should look? And, you know, and part of this is, of course, the post-colonial legacy, right? So there's a long history of regulating prostitution as a way of regulating the threat of kind of contagious disease, which, you know, so many amazing feminist historians have written about, you know, the anxieties around race and sexuality that were at the heart of, you know, the Contagious Disease Act, for example. Yeah. And how those moments actually kind of sex panics actually solidified these categories of the prostitute. But, you know, by the time I was studying kind of the early AIDS epidemic, there was that history, but there was also this relationship between India and the rest of the world, right? That public health researchers within India, as well as media, you know, or civil society, you know, they're all trying to figure out, okay, there's this pandemic happening in the West. Is it going to come here? Is this going to affect us? Right. And so I started kind of cataloging public health articles and news articles from that period, right? So like from the mid 80s. And, you know, what I found was that, you know, a lot of these, a lot of the discourses centered on both on positioning India in relation to both Africa and the West, right? So, you know, and in the early phases, it looked one way, right? So it was, okay, well, in the West, there's a lot of this sexual immorality, there's homosexuality. Since there's no homosexuality here in India, AIDS is not going to be a problem here, right? But then there's this shift, right? So and in that earlier moment, there was kind of a sense of third world solidarity. So if Africa is mentioned, it's mentioned in the context of, you know, these Western powers are trying to kind of bring their idea of public health and impose it on those of us in the third world and Africa and Asia, right? But later on, you know, as Africa starts to have this raging AIDS pandemic, right? Then there's this new set of fears, right? Because now it's, okay, well, if there can be an explosive AIDS pandemic in Africa, maybe that means there can be an explosive AIDS pandemic here, right? So then the concern becomes, how is India different from Africa, right? So now it's, okay, well, you know, we have a more sexually conservative society than Africa, right? And we are more technically advanced than Africa, right? So here, you know, so I mapped out, you know, in this first empirical chapter of the book, kind of how these imaginaries of both the West and Africa shifted over this period. But also, you know, these were also very concrete circuits of public health knowledge, right? So there were actually studies done in Kenya, for example, that were referred to in deciding to focus on sex workers as a major mode of transmission in India. And a lot of the same researchers were working across these contexts. Right. So they were actually taking with them, you know, certain assumptions and vocabularies and moving them across into a new context.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah. And, you know, you write so compellingly about how the strategies for HIV prevention were rife with contradictions in India, owing to the state's incapacity as well as its criminalization of marginalized groups. You argue that these tensions led to two kinds of strategies for managing the crisis: one that relied on a logic of containing and isolating risk, while another emphasized the need to incorporate high-risk groups into state programs. So could you tell us a little bit about these strategies and how the perhaps unintended consequences of these strategies shaped state-citizen relations?
Yeah, so, you know, early on, right, the state's response was, you know, essentially violent, right? And coercive, right? So the response was to detain anyone who was considered to be a risk. And so, for example, you know, in one really important case, you know, there were over 800 women who were brought from Bombay to Chennai on this train called Mukti Express. And they were detained in Chennai, and they were kind of in these very abusive conditions, and they were forcibly tested for HIV. There's the well-known case of Dominic D'Souza in Goa, who was arrested right when he was found to be HIV positive. And, you know, so this was kind of the early response, right, to kind of crack down on the people who were considered to be a threat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but what happened almost immediately was that there was activism, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, one of the key activists in this period was Shamla Natraj, right, from Siap, mm-hmm. who, you know, worked for the release of sex workers who were detained in Tamil Nadu. You know, so there was a shift after this initial period to a more kind of strategy, what I call it, call a strategy of incorporation, right? So working with community groups to kind of bring them on board within the public health response, mm-hmm. right? So, so instead of detaining sex workers and later on sexual minorities and transgender people, the idea was, okay, we'll work with the community, right? And they will do the HIV prevention work. And this created a lot of conflict, right? Because you have organizations who are actually sort of receiving funds from one set of agencies within the state, from NACO, and also being arrested and are still criminalized, mm-hmm. you know, and regularly attacked by other state agents, right? Mm-hmm. So this actually became a way of kind of outsourcing some of the violence associated with doing HIV prevention, right? So community groups are the ones who are kind of doing this work. And it's and the way that I talk about it in the book, it's kind of a way of very conditionally incorporating these groups, right? Saying, mm-hmm. you know, this is a temporary suspension of sexual morality. For as long as you're important to stopping this disaster from taking place, right? So they're incorporated into some parts of the state while leaving others largely unchanged. And then after the crisis is over, we'll all go back to normal. You'll be back to being kind of marginal in society, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the shift that took place and the kind of contradiction that I think is at the heart of the book.
Yeah, well, that's, again, really interesting. And I had never thought about many of these, you know, discrete events in this coherent manner. So thanks for bringing together such a compelling narrative. But my favorite chapter was the chapter titled Risky Selves, in which you write against the singular narrative of victimhood and instead show with much empathetic astuteness how your interlocutors found new opportunities of self-making that was opened up by the AIDS crisis. So one of the things that was really interesting was how the aspiration to becoming smooth is one self-transformation project that was quite dominant in these narratives. So I was hoping you could tell us how the HIV prevention programs created conditions for these self-making projects and these self-transformation potentials that that persisted.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad you liked that chapter. That's my favorite chapter too. I mean, there's been a lot of writing about, you know, HIV programs in India, you know, from people who are involved in it, as well as kind of academics studying it. And, you know, there are a couple of different, and, you know, obviously I'm caricaturing because there are lots of complex debates happening with within this area. But, you know, if you read like a Gates Foundation report or something, mm-hmm. one of the things that you'll often see is kind of the idea that HIV prevention interventions empowered people, right? So that the groups who were considered to be at risk were empowered by being part of these programs. And then there's this other, you know, activist critique, which is really important, right? Saying, you know, actually, this wasn't, you know, the HIV programs were not responsible for the empowerment. And in fact, all they did was kind of discipline people. You know, they created new inequalities. They excluded people who didn't kind of fit within the caste and class norms of, you know, respectable HIV prevention spaces. And so I, in this chapter, was interested in kind of making sense of that through my ethnographic data. And I think I, you know, I come out somewhere in the middle, but probably more on the side of the latter, to talk about how people are navigating these spaces. There were some very specific kind of infrastructural conditions created by HIV prevention, right? So one of the things were there were spaces, right? There were drop-in centers where people could hang out, right? And that's actually a pretty transformative thing, right? So this is a place where people are hanging out in a different kind of way. So when I was in drop-in centers, people would have dance parties, they were playing games, watching TV, people would be cooking. I remember there was somebody who used to dry apla, on the roof of the building to sell. There were just, it was a space where people were working and living together. And they were learning, ways to behave, way to classify themselves, way to name their sexuality. And they were also kind of engaging on this terrain of, learning how to be what I call smooth, right? So a lot of people would say, and they often, these would be English words kind of interspersed into Kannada. So, how to be more decent, how to be more smooth, instead of being rough, right? Learning how to dress differently, how to talk in front of, an audience, how to be part of a meeting, how to show up on time to a meeting, all of these kind of little things that people were learning, which, also meant, learning how to be quieter in some settings and also how to talk more assertively in other settings, right? So, I talk about selective openness, learning how to be open about your sexuality in the right context. But managing it in other contexts. So these are kind of some of the things that people talk to me about learning, kind of the transformations they described going through, right? And I, in that chapter, I focus on both transgender and cisgender women. And they described, actually remarkably similar kinds of transformations, obviously playing out in very different ways and in different kind of worlds and trajectories. But they described learning how to occupy these kind of office spaces over time. And it did include a loss, right? So it entails kind of a loss of more fluidity, right? A lot of people learned how to describe their sexuality with a really specific kind of rigid term, right? Instead of kind of having a more fluid understanding. And there were people I interviewed who described that as a loss, who kind of felt limited by that, by those kind of epidemiological classifications and terminologies. Right. But at the same time, those terminologies kind of give access to political spaces and give the basis to make claims, right? So it's a very kind of double-edged process. That I'm trying to make sense of in this chapter, but I really kind of try to center how ultimately it's these kind of individual negotiations with this space, and it's an opportunity and a space for self-making that both involves some kind of losses and as well kind of some opportunities and transformations and sort of ways to articulate aspirations in a different way.
The chapter on quantitative models of HIV prevention was also very powerful. And you argue that within the scientific community, quantification was key to repackaging the Indian AIDS response. And in the process of quantification, AIDS in India was severed from sexual politics. In other words, quantification made the AIDS response apolitical. So could you tell us a little bit what you mean by this and the implication that the imagining of data as numbers had on the global scale?
Yeah, so, when I was thinking about the structure of the book, I really didn't want to write a story that was all about what the donors did and how powerful the donors were, right? But I did realize at some point that I do have to address that, right? Because the donors did have a really important role in representing what had happened in India in the AIDS response in the global field, right? And in particular, the Gates Foundation did a huge amount of research on the HIV prevention programs that they were a part of, right? And intentionally, that this chapter comes late in the book, right? Because the Gates Foundation arrived to the AIDS response in India quite late, right? So a lot of these groups, organizations, state agencies had already sort of built a model of AIDS response and HIV prevention before the Gates Foundation arrived. And then the Gates Foundation kind of came in and brought in a whole lot of money and scaled everything up and did a ton of research and documentation, right? So Ashok Alexander, who was the director of Avahan in India, in his book, A Stranger Truth, he actually writes about how this was the most well-documented public health, one of the most well-documented public health programs in the world. There were 300 peer-reviewed journal articles about this HIV response in India, right? So they, so there was a lot of research going on and a lot of kind of attempt to quantify what community organizations had already been doing, right? Mm-hmm. So some of these activist groups, for example, had really pioneered something called crisis response, which was basically if somebody is being harassed or detained in the police station, somebody from the organization will go and help them get out, right? Or if somebody's in some kind of crisis situation, right? These kind of everyday crises that would happen to sex workers and sexual minorities and transgender people when they're kind of on the street. And so, you know, once the this large-scale program comes into place, now the peer educators have to document how many crisis interventions they did every week, right? And there are studies of, you know, how does crisis intervention affect HIV prevention, right? So, you know, I see this as kind of part of this larger logic of humanitarian donors, right? So you do an intervention, you evaluate it, and then you move on, right? You're not there to kind of stay and build relationships or build leadership, right? So you want your data, right? So there's this very research oriented logic, right, to these large scale interventions. Even though on the ground, you know, the peer educators, the community organizers, you know, organizations with, you know, all different political orientations, were skeptical of the documentation expectations, right? And this was not experienced as a valuable aspect of work on the ground. And there were activists who protested the targets that the HIV prevention program was setting, you know, after the Gates Foundation was in India. But, you know, if you look at like the peer-reviewed journal articles that were published out of this process, a lot of it is about numbers, right? So how this was a very quantitatively driven response, how data was really at the heart of it. So the Gates Foundation kind of saw that as their signature contribution to the response. And so what I tried to kind of show is that this was a very conflicted process, and that, you know, these community organizations already existed and were doing this work before the donors came in to quantify it. But then when they exported it to other places, it was the numbers that kind of took precedence. It became the numbers that were sort of seen to be the core of the program instead of what came after the program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super, super interesting. Towards the end of the book, you come back to this question of the relationship between India and Africa, specifically Kenya, by walking us through the collaborative efforts in the global AIDS field. The material was so rich in how it gives us a glimpse of the sociological thinking that your interlocutors engage in while making claims about other societies. So how did those engaged in HIV prevention work in India and Kenya compare the two countries vis-a-vis each other? And what do these comparisons tell us about the possibilities and the problems of South-South collaboration?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, this was, one of the parts of the project that was, you know, in a lot of ways that it took me the longest to kind of make sense of this, right? Because in some ways, you know, basically, I heard a lot of hierarchical language, right? These kind of racialized hierarchies that people would use to talk about the differences between India and Kenya, right? So a lot of comparisons of state capacity, right? The state the Kenyan state as more beholden to donors compared to the Indian state. And actually, you know, some of this, you know, I looked at the data on kind of funding, for example, and, you know, this is based on the reality of the fact that in Kenya, AIDS brings in a huge amount of foreign funding that outpaces funding for the rest of the health sector. And a lot of it comes from PEPFAR, which is a Bush era program. It has, you know, very kind of conservative political orientation compared to India, where, you know, AIDS was, you know, there was a lot of funding from the Gates Foundation and from other donors as well, from European donors. But it was never kind of as exceptionalized as in Kenya. So there are some differences there that I kind of try to map out. But what I was really interested in was how people narrate these differences, right? So people saying India is ahead, Kenya is behind. You know, India is where Kenya will be in 30 years. And also, you know, our comparisons about political culture, right? Indians are more argumentative. Kenyans are less argumentative. They're more accepting. Kenyans are more sexually conservative. Indians are more sexually tolerant. You know, so these are kind of ideas of sexual modernity. And I'll say also, I mean, the study is really of this relationship, right? So it's not so much of, you know, whether any of these narratives are based in any kind of reality, right? But it's about how these narratives are playing out. And I heard them from both, you know, Kenyan and Indian interviewees. But what I also saw was that, you know, people who were making these comparisons were also kind of reworking them in a lot of ways and finding ways to collaborate across them. So they were using some of this hierarchical language, but they were also kind of working in interesting ways to build solidarity, right? So this is a context where donors were more interested in adopting HIV prevention practices from India than they were in talking to local Kenyan activists, right, who had already been doing this work for years, right? So within this context, you know, and there were, like, you know, officials from, and not just Kenya, you know, several African countries who would go to India to learn about HIV prevention programs. But then when they would go, you know, one of the things that I heard from some of my interviewees was that people would go on these trips and they would come back and say, you know, the main thing I learned from my trip was that I don't have to listen to the donors, right? Or one of the projects that happened while I was in Kenya was this sex worker organization, Bar Hostesses Empowerment and Support Program. They decided to do a documentation report of all of the sex worker activism that had been ongoing in Kenya. And they wanted to kind of make the argument to the Kenyan AIDS authorities that, you know, okay, so you're interested in working with, you know, what you call key populations now. Here's all the work we've already been doing. Can we actually build on this? And they actually, you know, did this in collaboration with Indian HIV prevention staff, Meena Seshu, who's a sex worker activists from India, actually kind of came and did the research for this. And, you know, they put out this report, you know, so this is kind of, for me, an example of how even within this kind of hierarchical framework that was put in place by some of these ideas of knowledge transfer or learning from India's successful model, there were also moments of, you know, building solidarity across across activist groups.
Yeah, and in a way, it comes back to the questions of India and Africa in that you addressed in the first chapter. So it was a really nice way of coming back a full circle towards the end of the book. So as a final question about the book, I was wondering if you wanted to speak to the interventions this book makes in the sociology of state and sexual politics. In particular, I would be curious to know what are the texts that this book drew its energy from, and how do you think about its contributions to ongoing conversations?
Yeah, thanks for this question. And I love the question about the books that I draw my energy from, because there's so many. But yeah, I mean, I think overall, you know, what really drove this for me was sort of, you know, when we study global crises, global donors, global mm-hmm. feminist projects, global queer projects, you know, part of my goal with this was to look at how these moments play out on existing political terrains, often in mm-hmm. this very kind of localized ways, right? And how activists who are building, you know, very specific political alliances in their context are able to work within and beyond the frameworks that are imposed on them by donors mm-hmm. and the state, and to really kind of think about the state and donors and social movements or civil society as kind of three different entities that operate together in complicated ways. So, you know, in that way, like, I'm very indebted to some of the literature on just disaggregating the state, right? Seeing the state as this kind mm-hmm. of complex actor with conflicts within it, conflicts without it, that has right. to be understood in relation to civil society as well as some of these global institutions. Mm-hmm. So I think it is a feminist project too, because, you know, there's been a lot more work on and attention to this kind of project of disaggregating the state in sociology recently. But this is work that, you know, feminists and feminist sociologists have been doing for a long time. Right. And so I think, you know, for me, you know, scholarship on sexuality in the state was really useful for making sense of some of these contradictions within the state and the way the state relates to actors and institutions outside of it. I mean, in terms of some of the literatures and work that that the book draws its energy from, you know, one of the books actually that really helped me early on mm-hmm. that I read in grad school was Millie Thayer's Transnational Feminism book about mm-hmm. kind of the relationships between feminist groups in Brazil and how they have this kind of relationship of, you know, inequality but also solidarity across this mm-hmm. rural feminist kind of grassroots movement and this middle class urban NGO, right? And mm-hmm. so thinking about those relationships within the context of transnational feminist funding was really useful for me, really inspired by Jyoti Puri's work on sexuality in the state and kind of, you know, the feminist and queer critiques of the state that her work is part of. And also another book that really helped me think through the relationship between India and Africa was Antoinette Burton's Africa and the Indian Imagination, which kind of historicizes some of these, you know, complex relationships of both hierarchy and solidarity between India and, you know, a few different kind of sites in Africa. And then of course, you know, some of the work on global field. So Monica Krause's book, The Good Project, kind of helped me think about the global field. So I was putting a lot of things together in this book. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, I think of it as a methodological intervention too, you know, a way of thinking about global institutions from this perspective that's rooted in political assertions from marginalized groups, right? And in that way, you know, it's like going back to that, you know, Michael Burvoy Global Ethnography Project, right? That really kind of inspired me in graduate school. But the other thing I wanted to say actually was that, you know, I learned a lot from the writings of activists as I was building the theoretical framework for this. I think it's really important to kind of think about some of those writings as, you know, making theoretical interventions, right? Yeah, so some really kind of pioneering work that was done by activists who were working in these spaces, less than gay, by AIDS Bepa Virodhi Andolan, Women in AIDS, Denial and Blame. This is kind of an early report that they put out about kind of some of these early definitions of risk, right? Even that idea that the category of risk is placed on the others of the nation, right? Is that that mm-hmm. argument is made in that report. Shubha Chacko's Chasing Numbers, Betraying People, which is really a critique of quantification in HIV mm-hmm. prevention programs. There were these fact-finding reports done by human rights activists in Karnataka by People's Union for Civil Liberties that were about kind of policing, violent policing of sexual minorities and transgender people in mm-hmm. sex work. And they were documenting what was happening on the ground, and they were also generating theory and generating right. critiques. And there are several other reports and documents that I refer to. And so in my introduction, I really tried to kind of cite those alongside the kind of academic writings that I cited, mm. because they were both, you know, equally important to me in building yeah. the theoretical framework for the book.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely respect that so much. Okay, well, before we end, I would love to know what you're working on now and what can we expect to read from you in the near future?
Sure. So I have a few different things that are happening at once, and they're all at different phases of development. But I'll yeah. say something about my collaborations that I have ongoing
yeah.
first. So, you know, I have a collaborative project with Shubha Chacko and Subhadra Panchanadishwaran. And we've sort of been writing together on various topics for a long time. So mm-hmm. right now we're working on a project about sex worker, sexual minority and transgender organizations across the AIDS response and COVID-19. So kind of looking mm-hmm. at how they leveraged resources and navigated COVID-19 mm-hmm. and also kind of, you know, the activism that they have been doing across these periods. So that's one project. We're doing a project on aging and sex work, so looking mm-hmm. at kind of sex workers and how growing older kind of presents a new set of opportunities and constraints, and also you know, a new sort of set of vulnerabilities too. So those are two projects. I'm also working with Smita Radhakrishnan on editing this amazing volume, mm-hmm. The Sociology of South Asia, which is really an effort to kind of pull together some exciting new work by junior scholars in the sociology of South Asia, but also think about kind of how to, you know, decolonize sociology, bring North American sociology into conversation with sociologies produced in and on South Asia.
Mm-hmm.
I've also been working this past year, one of my favorite projects I've done this past year is working with this wonderful transgender activist, Akkai Padmashali, who mm-hmm. I worked with her this year on writing her autobiography. Wow. So through a series of interviews, which I did with a couple of undergraduate students, at Brandeis, and so we put together, you know, this book, and it's actually been also released in Canada already, and
That's
it's
amazing.
Gonna be and it's gonna be out hopefully next year with Zuban in English. So mm-hmm. that's a really exciting project and has given me a chance to kind of engage in a really exciting way. So I have, you know, these collaborations going on. In my kind of work outside of collaborations, I'm really interested in thinking about kind of the dynamics of love and romantic relationships within a transnational context. And so I've started to think about kind of how to do a project on diasporic love and romance. And so I'm teaching a course on the sociology of love in the fall to kind of pull together kind of what's the sociological literature on love. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping to kind of build that into to a project on love in the South Asian diaspora.
Wow. I mean, all of these sound so cool, and I can't wait to read all of the projects in the making. And I particularly love the one on love. And You know, if you ever need an interviewee, please, I will volunteer my myriad experiences. But, you know, Kauri, thanks so much for taking time out to chat with me today about your fantastic new book. It's really such an accomplishment and major, major congratulations. And I'm not just saying that because I've always already admired everything you do. But it's great, and I'm sure it's going to be really well received, and it's going to pick up all the admiration and attention it rightly deserves.
Well, thank you so much for engaging so closely with the book. This is the first time I've actually gotten to talk about it since it's been out. So I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, well, thanks. Take care and stay safe.
Thanks, you too.